Our program today is the annual wrap-up of the General Assembly session. And it is my honor and privilege to introduce our speakers and moderate this program. We invited five legislators, not only Cree Deeds and David Toscano, but also Delegates Rob Bell and Steve Landis, and State Senator Bryce Reeves. They were unfortunately unable to come, but these sessions have never been known for their brutal partisanship, and I don't think today's will be. Let me introduce our speaker, starting with Senator Cree Deeds. Cree represents all of Charlottesville and most of Albemarle County. He served in the General Assembly since 1992 and was his party's nominee for Attorney General in 25 and Governor in 29. Cree serves on three important committees in the Senate: Courts of Justice, Privileges and Elections, and Transportation. He also chairs the Joint Subcommittee seeking to improve our mental health laws and practices. Next, Delegate David Toscano. David represents all of Charlottesville and most of the urban ring of Albemarle County. He served in the General Assembly since 2006, and before that he was on the Charlottesville City Council for 12 years. In the House, David has shown his leadership by having been chosen repeatedly as his party's leader. He serves on three major committees also: Courts of Justice, Transportation, and Rules. David typically has a PowerPoint presentation, so we'll begin with him. Welcome to these wonderful gentlemen.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you today. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, but Cree and I do this kind of together, and so as I hit slides, when he interrupts, he's not being obnoxious. He's still respectful. I encourage him to do that. It's great to be with you. We like coming here every year. How many folks first time here? Oh, a good bunch of them. And how many people live in the city? Oh, a lot. And the rest of you in the county, or you live in Waynesboro? Okay, great. Thanks. Good to see you guys. Okay, so I supposedly this works. Oh, it works backwards. Okay. All right. So the title of this is that last year it was called Legislating in the Shadow of Washington's Chaos. And so rather than think of a new title, I just said, well, let's just put still legislating in the bush, because that's kind of what we're doing here. See if this works. Okay, this is what it looks like, our fine map of the Commonwealth of Virginia. We got, there were elections this year, and you can't explain what's going on in the General Assembly without understanding the elections of 2017, which elected Ralph Northam to be our governor, Justin Fairfax to be our lieutenant governor, and Mark Herring was reelected to be attorney general. They all happened to be Democrats. Here's what the composition of the House and the Senate looked like in 2017, before the election. The Senate wasn't up in 2017, but the House was. And so you're going to see a pretty interesting change in this chart. 49-51, big change. 15 new people came into the House who were Democrats, and that changed a lot of what's going on in Richmond. If things had gone a little bit differently, you see that little vase there, that's where they picked out the lot that determined what would happen in a tied election in Newport News. Remember, there was a tied election in Newport News after the recount. They pulled out a Republican, and the Republicans got the majority in the House of Delegates, 51-49. It's hard to believe, isn't it, really, that something as significant as that could hang on a taking of a lot. And, you know, pretty amazing thing. Who says that your vote does not count? All right, so just to give some flavor of some of the things that we do in Richmond, some of which are really serious and important, and some of the things are not really that serious and important. So let's talk about the things that aren't. We did pass with broad bipartisan consensus, and in the Senate, even the Senate voted for this bill, didn't you, Cree?
Voted for it, yeah.
Okay.
I'm more common with that on the end of a fishing line than...
You know what convinced him is when we handed out little pictures of this little guy, and that's what convinced all the senators to vote for this bill. But we do have a new state salamander to join the list of state animals. For those of you who have come many years before, we did have a state reptile a couple years ago that got to the House floor but then was smashed and was voted down. So we don't have a state reptile. It was a turtle. Now, raccoons didn't turn out to have so much luck in the General Assembly session this year. We removed the prohibition on hunting raccoons on Sundays after 2 a.m. So, raccoons, watch out. For you companion animal fans, we did change a law that now allows dogs inside or on the premises of a winery, brewery, or distillery. So you can see that. Maybe this was more serious than I thought. Of course, I don't know what you're going to do with the cats. They must still drink at home. We have a new confectionery license that allows you to inject alcohol into confections. You like that, Bill, too?
Yeah, candy or
yeah, good
cupcakes.
So you can put it in the ice cream. All right. Now let's get down to serious.
The Beer Museum.
Beer Museum.
That's a serious one as well.
This came out of Senate. You know, I didn't pay as much attention to
that. They are a special museum license. You know, in Virginia, we don't have bars. You've got to meet your food ratio wherever you sell alcohol, but we've created exceptions for distilleries and different places where they make farm wineries so they can sell samples, and we created a museum license for the Beer Museum.
For the Beer Museum. How many people have been here have been to the Beer Museum? Anybody? I don't even know where it is.
I don't either.
Well, now you can go. Okay. Now you can go and you can get beer on grounds. All right. So seriously, we do not have a budget yet. This is the... this year was a long session. As you know, many of you know, we are citizen legislators. We have real jobs. Cree and I are attorneys, and we were practicing probably this morning doing our work. And we come into session 1 year for 60 days. That's the long session where we pass a two-year budget. And then the second year we come in for 46 days. That's the short session. This year is the long session. We're supposed to pass a two-year budget. We didn't pass it. And the biggest barrier is Medicaid expansion. So I'm going to tell the House story. You can tell the Senate story. In the House, for years, the Democrats have been... I'm a Democrat, for those of you who don't know that. The Democrats have been pushing to expand Medicaid. When the Affordable Care Act was passed, part of the provisions were that states would have to expand Medicaid and be compensated from the federal government 100% of the cost. That was a requirement of the original ACA. It was challenged in the courts, and the courts ruled that states could not be compelled to expand Medicaid. So states had to choose to expand Medicaid, and a number of them did, but Virginia did not. So for a long time, a number of us have been pushing to expand Medicaid. It had typically been defeated in the House. But here's where elections matter. There are now 49 Democrats in the House, and I think part of the reason why the Republican leadership in the House embraced Medicaid expansion is they felt that election, and they realized that health care was the number one issue in that election. As a result, we decided in the House to pass a budget that included Medicaid expansion. That allowed us to take a lot of federal dollars that we were not able to get. It's been about $10 billion over the last 5-6 years. Bring some of that money into our budget so we could fund things that were going to be important, like teacher raises, state police raises, etc. Now, on the Senate side...
Well, here's the thing about Medicaid expansion. It basically would put over 300,000 Virginians, 75% of whom either work full-time or live with somebody that does. So you're talking about the working poor. It would make them eligible for Medicaid. Over 300,000 people would suddenly have access to preventative care, and it would be... It could be a life-changing event for a whole lot of people. It would also pump about $2 billion, federal dollars, into Virginia a year. The difference in our budget, what David's talking about, amounts to about $621 million in real dollars and on impact on our two-year budget. That would allow for many of the things they paid for in the House to be paid for. Now, the thing about the Senate... In the past, we've more or less supported Medicaid expansion, but the Republican majority has been reluctant to go along recently. We haven't been at an election in the Senate since 2015, so I'm a Democrat, but the guys in the Senate who are Republicans are a little less likely to be concerned about what happened in 2017. The frustrating thing about it is this: you go back a few years, 2013. The budget. We had language in the budget that said once we reform A, B, and C, to make sure we have accountability, make sure we can do things our way, make sure we can control eligibility, we'll reform Medicaid. We did those things, and still we met resistance. The House of Delegates now has given up their resistance, and we're stuck. We'll go back into session on Monday, and I'm hopeful that we can, over the next course of the next two or three weeks, can get Medicaid expanded.
So here it is. The difference is Medicaid, and Senator Deeds pointed out it's a $600 million difference. If you accept Medicaid expansion, you got $600 million that comes into your budget. If you don't, well, actually it's $400 million, but if you don't, you got to figure out a way to find $400 million in cuts, which means probably no teacher raises and a lot less money for other things.
The difference between my number and his number is that that money frees up other dollars from things. So there's about a $621 million difference between the Senate, the version of the budget the Senate passed in February and the version that the House passed.
Yeah, actually, that is absolutely right. We got a $600 million difference right now we have to make up. And right now, the House Republican leadership and the Senate Republican leadership are at loggerheads. And we're hoping we get to vote at some point, right, Cree?
Well, yeah. Monday, the Mental Health Commission that I work on met in Williamsburg, and Senator Hanger is a member of that commission. He's also a co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and he told me the plan is for us to meet on Monday, to send the bill to the Finance Committee, for the Finance Committee to meet Monday and Tuesday, and hopefully for the Senate to get a budget passed out by Thursday or Friday of next week. That'll set up the conference process. Hopefully we can get a budget done within two or three weeks after next week.
Something doesn't make sense here.
Well,
this money's coming in for Medicaid.
Excuse me.
We'll get a chance here. Okay. We'll have a chance to take your questions in a minute. And as you notice, there are differences of opinion from reasonable people about Medicaid expansion. It is complicated, and we'll take your questions to deal with the complexities. Okay, so next, some other significant stuff that got done. One of the significant bills that got passed was a bill to change a little how we regulate utility rates and how we try to find a way to rebate to consumers monies that they would have otherwise gotten had the law not changed a couple years ago. There were two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, and the bills that passed out, you will see a change in your bill at some point, which will include a credit for so-called over-earnings that the utilities had. The bill also included about $1 billion for low-income weatherization, and a lot of new solar initiatives.
There are no questions that this bill does some good things, but it still didn't do enough good things to get my vote. In 2015, the legislature took a step, the wrong step, with another Dominion-sponsored piece of legislation that removed them from their rate making from the review of the State Corporation Commission, froze certain rates, but not all the rates. And their justification for doing that was the Clean Power Plan that President Obama proposed. It never became the law, and it's not the law now. In the meantime, President Obama leaves office. We get a new president, and Dominion has reaped more than hundreds of millions of dollars in excess profits. So this legislation was an effort to turn that back. I didn't vote for it because it doesn't refund all of the profits. It changes the biennial review to a triennial review, so the State Corporation Commission has less control than they would have otherwise had. And I just don't think it's a good deal for Virginia consumers. But it does do some good things. It returns some money, and it requires Dominion to create, I think, 5,000 megawatts of solar power.
There were some changes in the school suspension policies that would mean that youngsters who had behavioral problems could only be suspended for a certain period of time. The rationale behind this bill was that we were finding that some youngsters would be suspended and basically sent home for long periods of time, and they'd have no contact with the schools, and they'd get into trouble, and some of them might end up in jail. And so that's why you hear that the term school-to-prison pipeline, because if you're not in school and you're not being, you're not learning things and you're not being socialized, sometimes you can turn to things that end you up in jail. So
this is a tougher subject than you would think, because running schools is primarily a local matter. Localities have to run schools. Last year, I voted against this bill, but I voted for the bill this year because it has a requirement in there that kids can't be suspended long term unless the school board or the principal can justify why they're being suspended in writing. And I didn't think that was an unreasonable burden for local localities to have to undergo. And there's substantial evidence about the school-to-prison pipeline. So I thought this was a much better bill.
Yeah, and there are a lot of balances here, because if you are a parent, you certainly want to make sure that your child is safe in a classroom. If you are a teacher, you want to be able to teach kids without having disruption. So you've got, on the one hand, that important element. On the other hand, you want to make sure that youngsters aren't taken out of the classroom and then set aside and essentially given up on. So you have to figure out what the proper balance is. This bill does a good thing towards creating that balance. It gives school boards options to essentially say that, yeah, this one's serious enough that we're going to keep him or her out of the class. DNA database, this was my bill, so I like to talk about it. This was a bill that Hannah Graham's mom and dad came to testify for. You remember Hannah was the person who was killed in Charlottesville several years ago. And as a result of this, we came up with this bill that will require the taking of DNA samples from people who are convicted of misdemeanor offenses. If we had taken the DNA sample of the guy who killed Hannah Graham, that DNA sample would have been in the DNA database when he raped a person in Fairfax several years before he killed Hannah Graham. When he raped that person in Fairfax, they didn't catch him. They didn't catch Jesse Matthew. They didn't have a way to catch him. But if his DNA sample had been in the database, they would have gotten a hit on him, and they would have gotten him. He would have been in jail rather than meet Hannah Graham that night that he killed her. So this bill passed, and I hope that it'll make it. DNA is powerful. It can exonerate the innocent, and it can convict the guilty. So this will expand the database. Felony larceny threshold was increased to $500. Previously, it had been at $200, and it had been that since the 1980s, right? 1980s?
82.
These are two bills that Senator Deeds had, and I think it's important for him to talk about them because they're pipeline-related bills.
Well, the pipelines have been in the news significantly over the last couple of years. They're not projects that the General Assembly has direct control over or can approve or disapprove. But what this legislation does essentially is give DEQ authority that I thought they already had, but they don't. This says that they can stop work if water quality is threatened through a soil erosion or land disturbing work or a flood control problem.
Yeah, we don't get to vote on the pipelines. I don't know if people have heard that a number of times, but we've never had a bill to support the pipelines or say no, but these are bills that will actually help make sure that DEQ does its job.
That's right. There was one more pipeline-related bill that passed the session. Senator Hanger from Augusta County had it, and it basically requires more upstream planning for pipeline potential disturbances. It probably will have more of an impact on future pipeline projects than these two, but it's still good to get in the books.
Okay, lots of things left to do. Well, we can't Medicaid. We don't know what's going to happen with that yet, so we'll have to just see. This slide's up here because what is happening in Washington, and again, please excuse me if this is a partisan slant, but I do feel very strongly about this, is that really the administration is trying to undermine the ACA, and they're doing it in a couple of ways. One is, they are not going to provide the subsidies to the insurance companies to help keep down the cost of insurance coverage within the exchanges. Secondly, they fought very hard against keeping the individual mandate. The result of that is that people who do not have health problems pull out of the insurance market, therefore making it more costly for insurance companies to insure those people who are still in the pool. It's a principle of economics, and I think most people understand how that works. So you have the undermining of the ACA, and one of the practical impacts of that has been felt right here in this community, where the only company that's providing insurance outside of employer-based coverage is Optima, and they now have the largest insurance premiums in the country. And they, partly because there's no competition. There used to be competition, but that changed. And they've raised their rates because they have concluded that their population that they have to insure is more costly to insure, and they do what every good company would do. They assess the risk, and they price the risk. And the risk is higher, the price has gone up, and people are paying.
We saw in this region the effects of the instability that was created in Washington. What the General Assembly could do is very limited. Probably the best way we could deal with this is to create some sort of reinsurance program. Other states have done that. Minnesota's the one probably closest in size to us that's done it, and it costs about $250 million. $250 million extra dollars aren't just laying around.
That we don't have. And that might be the only way you could do it at the state level. It really has to be solved at the federal level.
That's right.
Okay, supporting our teachers. This is kind of an interesting slide. This is Teacher Appreciation Week, right?
Yes.
That's right. Okay, so put this slide up here because it's kind of interesting. Virginia average pay for teachers is 34th out of the 50 states and $9,200 behind the national average. And since 2008, we've removed about 5,000 support positions from our public schools because of budgetary constraints. Virginia is the 10th wealthiest state in the country, and yet our teacher pay in constant dollars actually fell by 8.5% since 2009 in constant dollars. So it's kind of an interesting development that has occurred. Teachers, we have a teacher shortage in Virginia. And if you ask teachers what will get more people engaged in the profession, they'll tell you two things. One is pay, and two is having a work environment makes more sense. These support positions help teachers do their work. Right. And so it's not just about the money. It's also about the support.
But we've really not caught up. We've fallen behind since the recession. We haven't, as David pointed out, we haven't caught up to 2009 levels. We basically have a feeder system of teacher supply in Virginia. The Bath counties, the Highland counties, the Page counties, the Greene counties, Madison, we're at the bottom. Teachers come from there to Stanton, Augusta, Charlottesville, Albemarle, Henrico, up to Loudoun and Prince William and Fairfax, ultimately in Arlington, Alexandria, and they cross the river and they make $10,000 more in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's a very real problem. It seems to me the teacher shortage is going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, and rural communities are really going to take the heat. They should be screaming bloody murder because their school divisions is very hard to stock with teachers. One of the things that's great about Charlottesville and Albemarle is we have a relatively wealthy community. And the extent to which the state doesn't step up to support teachers with salary increases, the localities can step up. But when you start moving farther south where the tax base is not that great and there's not that much revenue coming to the local government, it really is dicey to try to figure out a way to enhance the pay of teachers. And you're feeling a lot of your districts.
Right.
So even with changes in the House, some things did stayed the same. There were no gun safety bills that were passed. No increases in the minimum wage. Voter rights weren't made any easier. We couldn't even get an agreement on a distracted driving bill. So all you guys who distracted drive all the time, you all text while drive, right? You all do that all the time, right? Yeah, you can still do it. There are some efforts underway on school safety. There's a select committee on school safety of the House of Delegates. It's bipartisan. It's also the Democratic Caucus has a Safe Virginia initiative out there looking at gun safety. This is for you. This we didn't do anything about. Now, can anybody tell me what this one is? This is the Rorschach test.
Three.
You know what it is.
Which one?
The one in the middle.
One in the middle.
Oh, this one.
Goofy kicking Donald Duck.
Yeah, that's it. But you know what state it's in?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. So this district no longer exists because the courts ruled that it was unconstitutional and have redrawn the districts. So there. Look at the North Carolina district. Then here are a couple in Virginia. Terry's trying to change that. You don't care about that. All right. What's next? Republican primary's next. It's about a month away. I don't get to vote in that one. Then, of course, November 6th, election for the U.S. Senate and House. 2019, the entire General Assembly is up. The governor is not up. It's just the Senate and the House. And it'll be the last legislative election before the decennial redistricting. That's how you contact us. Memorize it. We'll have a quiz at the end of this. Senator Deeds, you want to embellish on some of that stuff?
I don't. There's no need to embellish on it, I guess. The gun bill that did pass, the one gun bill, was a bill I introduced, 669, and it's a simple bill, and probably the reason it passed is because most people thought it was already the law. Certainly I did. What it says is that if you're under 18 or you're subject to a temporary detention order, you're not eligible to have a gun once you're 18. And it's one of those bills that was brought to me by some pretty tragic circumstances. A father from Stafford County wrote me a letter, and his son had attempted to kill himself twice, been hospitalized twice, and he said, well, when I turn 18, I'm going to get a gun. And when he turned 18, he disappeared. Now, the gun that he bought was bought legally because the temporary detention order did not go into the data bank because there was no law requiring it to go into the data bank. You know, if you're an adult and you're subject to a temporary detention order, that goes into the data bank and you're not eligible to purchase a firearm. So this kid basically was able to carry out his wishes, I guess, but we changed the law.
Well, now to move on to question and answers, but we podcast all our programs, so wait before asking your question until you get a microphone. Raise your hand, we'll bring you a microphone. Also, if you have or think you may have a follow-up question, keep the microphone.
Thanks. I'm trying to understand the math. There's 300,000 people that you want to expand to get Medicaid expansion. Is that 1,000 a year apiece? Is it 6,000? It's probably 6,000. So I don't understand where this money you're going to save to, or you're going to have to cut is coming. I don't understand the arithmetic that you're explaining. You're going to get tax money.
Here's the arithmetic. Okay, people that make more than $200,000 a year and couples that make more than $250,000 a year are already paying a surtax for Medicaid expansion. Virginians pay about $2.9 billion into this fund that we don't get anything back for. 300,000 people would be all at once. We think there are more than 300,000 people that are eligible for it. The reason it saves money on the budget is because there are already things we're doing for some programs that will affect those low-income people. And because we won't have to spend that any money anymore, and we'll save money in the budget when the Medicaid expansion dollars come in.
So, you know, and another way to look at this is right now, I mean, I think this is a really important question, and it's very complicated. And you know, because you say, well, okay, there's 300,000 people. How much per person is it going to cost, right? Well, it doesn't cost anything if somebody doesn't access it. So if you go to the ER or you go to the doctor's office, you access it. Unlike a number of states, Virginia has what's called managed care, which means that if you're in Medicaid, you have a case manager who helps direct you, not to the ER, which is the most expensive way, but to a private physician, which will be less costly. So people who are not on Medicaid, who don't have a case manager, and think about, and maybe don't have a doctor, probably don't, get sick and they end up in the ER. So when they end up in the ER, it costs a certain amount. Let's say it's $5,000 a visit, all right? That $5,000 a visit gets paid for in a couple different ways. One way it gets paid for is that if you went to UVA, for example, the state in its budget might reimburse UVA for what's called indigent care for that person. And in fact, it's $100 million a year that the state, through its budget, is reimbursing UVA for indigent care. So if those people are on Medicaid and they go to the doctor, they get the Medicaid reimburses the doctor, and you don't have to reimburse UVA. I'm not saying it's dollar for dollar savings, but it is a savings. Now, the other way uncompensated care gets reimbursed is it doesn't get reimbursed. And what happens then? That means all of us who have insurance pay higher rates because we're helping pay for that person who wasn't compensated. So that's how complicated it gets. So when you bring the money, federal dollars in, you are replacing dollars in some cases that were being paid out of the state budget. That's how the savings comes. The other good thing about the way Medicaid expansion works is that right now, for every dollar, if you're in the Medicaid system, every dollar, state dollar, that gets spent only gets reimbursed 50 cents from the federal government. With a Medicaid expansion population, for every dollar, you're going to get 94 cents from the feds. Now, whether that'll hold up or not, no one knows, but that's what you get now. And that's another way you save a little money on it.
Thank you.
Sure.
Next question, ma'am. Madison.
Thank you for telling us where we stand in terms of redistricting reform, and it's a concern that I have that I think is very nonpartisan and very important. And there is an organization, as I'm sure you know, called One Virginia 2021 that is advocating redistricting reform And the current proposal is a constitutional amendment, and I wonder what your take on that possibility is.
Well, I'll let Cree speak first because he had the constitutional amendment in the Senate several times. So
I've introduced constitutional amendments many times since 2002 to change redistricting. And the way I would do it might be a little different than Virginia 2021. I don't know. But I think the way to do it, people like me and David that have a vested interest in redistricting because we're running in the districts shouldn't have the ultimate control. We shouldn't be picking the people that vote for us. They should be picking the people they vote for. What my proposal would be would create this 13-member commission that's modeled after something New Jersey put in place, have six Democrats and six Republicans. They pick a chair who's an independent, not affiliated with either party, unelected to anything, and they have to pick it by majority vote. And then I would marry that New Jersey commission to the Iowa criteria that essentially says the only thing you can consider is population. We're Voting Rights Act states, so to a certain extent you have to consider race as well. But there's got to be a better way than the way historically we've done it.
What kind of legislation would be required for that to happen?
Well, it'd be a constitutional amendment. I've carried constitutional amendments any number of times to it. You can't. The Constitution right now, you see, says that the General Assembly does redistricting. So you can pass all the bills in the world, but they won't hold up. You've got to take it outside of the General Assembly, in my view. There are other people that disagree, both Democrats and Republicans that disagree. There are a lot of people that would say, hey, the Democrats won 15 seats in a badly gerrymandered House of Delegates. They won 15 seats last year. That's proof that the current system works. I don't agree with that. I think they won 15 seats because, in large part because you got a very unpopular president, and then you also had very good campaigns that the Democrats ran in with an energized base. But I still think there's a better way to do redistricting.
And I think you will need a constitutional amendment. There are bills that we have considered which are so-called criteria bills that say the General Assembly believes that if you're going to do redistricting, your criteria should be the following, and then there's a list that has to do with, you know, whether you favor incumbents, whether you favor a political party, a whole host of criteria, which are good in them in and of themselves, but it's not written into the Constitution. We had a criteria, well, we had language from the governor that came down to us in the veto session that would have installed criteria, but it was rejected in the House.
In the Senate. There were bills that passed this year that cherry-picked some criteria from old bills, but not all the criteria. And in my view, it just basically locked in place the status quo. The worst thing to do for a politician is to say you're doing something and convince people you're doing something and not really do anything. And I didn't think the bill did anything. And when the governor got it, he made it do something. He plugged in the rest of the criteria that we've all talked about for years and years, and it came back down and was rejected.
Yes, sir.
I want to turn you back to the complexities in Medicaid expansion and ask you each to comment on adding a work requirement to expansion in two aspects. Is it good public policy, period, and where does it fit in the politics of just getting this done?
That's a great question because it is a two-part question.
You want to start?
The work requirement was one of the things that the Republicans in the House of Delegates wanted to plug into it. And there are a lot of people that might be opposed to work requirement. I'm a real practical thinking guy, and it seemed to me politically necessary to have some sort of work requirement. I think as long as the work requirement carries with it some job training and education component so you can qualify if you are working or preparing for work or educating yourself for work, that's fine. I can go along with that because it's practically you have to do it to get the votes. The other side of it is it doesn't offend me. The Medicaid population, Medicaid expansion population, 75% of them already work full time or live with somebody that does. Now let me tell you about the current Medicaid population. 70% of them don't work. They live. You know what? They're nursing homes. their Medicare population who have spent out everything they've got. So we're not talking about applying that work requirement to the existing Medicaid population. It's not impossible. It's not practical. But for the Medicaid expansion population, nothing about it offends me. I think it's important to get this legislation passed.
You're right. There's a political element to it, and I think some work requirement will have to be included in the legislation in order for it to pass. It's going to have to be there because the Republicans, I think, are not going to allow it to pass without it. On the policy side, it's much more complicated because on the one hand, you want to encourage able-bodied people who have access to public benefits to work, and if they can't work, to be trained to be worked, to work. So those things in the bill could help, but as Cree said, you're talking about a relatively small number of people, and folks don't understand that sometimes the administrative overhead involved in doing that overwhelms the savings you would get by getting people to work. So it becomes very complicated. And the other thing that happens, and this is what we don't want to have happen, the purpose of it would be to get more people access to insurance. If you put so many barriers in there, it makes it difficult for people to get access, and you potentially start expanding it to the entire Medicaid population, it could create some real problems. But I think we're going to pass something like that, and we'll just have to figure out how it works in the real world, devoid from the political nature of it.
Okay, let's talk about the arguments against Medicaid expansion, possibly what the opposition's points are to argue against expanding.
Well, I mean, the opponents do have some reasonable arguments on Medicaid expansion and not it. They would argue, and, you know, if Steve Landis was here or Rob Bell, I mean, they make very cogent arguments as to why they don't think it's a good idea. Rob is great because all of you come here. I don't think I'm telling tales out of, but he comes, he usually has a book, and he says, do you know how much the budget has increased since I came into the General Assembly, right? So I'm playing Rob Bell. He plays me, too, sometimes, if I don't show up. But it is true that Medicaid, as a portion of our budget, has been expanding. And so the potential exists that you will crowd other kinds of needs out of the budget. That's a real concern. The other concern I think they would have, and you tell me if I'm being too persuasive here, is that you're never quite sure if the feds will live up to their part of the bargain. I don't think that argument is as strong, but it is an argument that you'd have to be concerned about, especially what's going on in Washington. You don't know what they're going to do. I mean, because right now, the feds are going to pay 94 cents of every dollar for Medicaid expansion. But will it stay that way? It goes down to 90. But will it stay that way? Will they drop it to 50? The only argument against them dropping it is all these other states out there are getting this advantage too. I think it'd be political, might be political suicide if they did something like that. But they could do it. And so I think those are the two of the arguments that I hear most frequently.
And those are the two big arguments. One is that the feds are going to cut it out. Well, people have been making those arguments about Medicaid and Medicare since 1965. Okay, and now there are 32 states that have adopted Medicaid expansion. They include the majority representation in Congress. And I just don't think that Congress is going to unfund a program that benefits the majority of people in their states, number one. So, and the number two thing is the cost of Medicaid as it stands is exploding. Now, that's a good argument. But the reason isn't because a lot of people are standing around looking for handouts. It's because a lot of people in nursing homes have spent down all of their resources. As a society, we failed to really think and plan for long-term living. You know, none of us really thought we were going to be able to live as long as we have, and so we haven't planned for it. And Medicaid is the payer of last resort, and that's causing the cost of Medicaid to to explode. Does that mean we don't look for a way to insure these people that don't have insurance? I don't think that's good. I think that's a cop out. I think we have to put more thought into the long term issue. We have to look at the way we pay for nursing home care and for old age.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, if you look at a loved one who's facing a nursing home care, and the options aren't good, it's very hard to say, look, I don't have the money.
Bob McGrath.
Wrong hand.
Energy. You voted in the end against House Bill 1558, right?
I did.
Yeah, because it wasn't good enough.
It wasn't good enough.
Right. So what's the outlook for a better kind of bill?
Well, I think,
could you just remind us why it wasn't good enough?
So we were talking about the energy bill that we had before this session, and that energy bill was designed to recompense ratepayers who had, I guess you could say, overpaid over the last several years. It was also a bill that would allow ratepayers to get some benefit out of the federal tax bill that the utilities benefit from. And it was a bill that would encourage more solar and renewable energy and encourage more weatherization of low-income folks, low-income people's homes. One of the things that was in the bill that I didn't like was taking away the public regulation of the utilities. As Cree said, I mean, usually what happens if the utilities want a rate increase, they have to go to the State Corporation Commission. This is a commission that has a professional staff. There are three judges on the State Corporation Commission. They look at the submission and they say, well, given the submission, we're going to improve this rate increase, or we're going to deny it, right? So you have a regulatory body overseeing the utilities and what they charge, because we legislators don't have that kind of skill. So we got to have somebody empowered to do it. So I didn't like the bill because you're taking away some of the power of the SEC.
Right.
You know, that being said, we've got to get a better SEC. We have to have an SEC who understands that the United States of 2018 is different from the United States of 1924, where everybody was just concerned on making sure their lights went on at a reasonable cost. We've got these huge issues about what the grid is going to look like. You know, how do you plan for the future with renewable energy? A lot of those things. We don't have, I mean, I like the people on the SEC, but we need some visionaries there to really understand it. I've taken too much of your time.
The bill, you know, the SEC, State Corporation Commission, grew out of railroad monopolies, and their monopolies over pricing and that in the 1880s and 1890s. And so we started the 20th century with the State Corporation Commission. I voted against the bill because they turned the biennial review of the pre-2015 bill into a triennial review. So they lessened the State Corporation Commission control, as David pointed out, and because the money that they returned through the bill doesn't amount nearly to what Dominion and Appalachian Power overcharged over the course of the 3 years since the 2015 legislation. Here's ultimately the problem, and David touched on it. These energy bills are all very complicated. David and I are part-time legislators. Being in the legislature is a full-time responsibility, but it's a part-time job. We are lawyers. We're not energy regulators. We hire a state corporation, or we appoint a state corporation commission, give them authority, allow them to hire the experts. That's where the technical work needs to be done. The General Assembly is not the appropriate place to handle these technical bills. But because the energy companies don't get what they want from the State Corporation Commission, they bypass them and come to the General Assembly.
And if you want to find out, if you really want to try to understand or really know how complicated this is, a lot of you have read court cases before, right? They're hard to read. You try reading a State Corporation Commission decision, Boy, if you want an easy way to get to bed at night, you sit down with one of those things, you'll be out in the first paragraph. But you had a follow-up, Bob.
Well, so the outlook is
Bob,
not up to
Bob, the- Mike.
What?
Hard to train some people.
So you're not. Neither one of you are sanguine about the possibility to do these things better.
I think the way to do them better is for us to have a division, a clear division of authority between the General Assembly and the State Corporation Commission, and for the technical work to happen there. When it comes to answering making final decisions, the General Assembly's the place where it ought to happen. We're the people's branch of government, but the technical work ought to be done over there. And these bills, and I've been in the General Assembly for a number of years, and these bills have come before the General Assembly any number of times over those years. They're bigger bills and more technical than we ought to be dealing with, than we have the staff to deal with or the expertise.
But, it's funny. I'm very optimistic about the future of energy, and mainly because I've seen how things have changed in the General Assembly. We've got younger people in the General Assembly now than we did before. We got people who are interested in these issues in ways they weren't before. We're seeing a lot of energy on the private sector side. I'm a firm believer that commerce is the engine of change. And if you look out there and you look at all of the companies that are now in the energy space and are demanding different ways of doing things. You've got a Microsoft that's saying, look, we're not locating here until you give us solar energy. And the same thing for Google or Apple or any of these other companies, IKEA. They're dictating to the market. And you've got all these new companies in Virginia, Apex, huge wind company here in Charlottesville, changing the market. Once you see battery and energy storage technologies start taking off, then everything is going to change. The utilities will not be able to control the General Assembly because there are going to be too many other interest groups out there fighting for their little piece of that energy pie. I think that's going to change how we consume energy, I think, in the next two decades. So I'm optimistic.
Virginia?
I want to thank both of you again, like last year and every other year, for coming. I also want to ask Craig Eads if he paid attention to what Mr. Perriello and what David did in recruiting people to run for the General Assembly. They gathered anybody who was interested in running, as I understand it, in the D.C. area, and gave them input on how to do it and what it meant and how difficult it is, but what can be done, and offered help from the current members of the General Assembly. And I'm hoping that will happen for our Senate run, too.
We're talking to people all the time, and we've been talking to people. We just haven't been on the ballot since 2015. We have a number of people. The problem we have is a problem David had to a certain extent. We have a lot of candidates and a lot of races, a lot of places, and it's almost an embarrassment of riches. But I fully expect us to have some very good candidates next year and some of the seats that we're going to challenge in. And I would expect the Democrats to take the Senate in 2021. I'd expect the Democrats to take the House in 2021,
and good
2019 rather.
And good candidates, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, help the process. I mean, to train people who are interested in how to run, what to talk about. I mean, not every candidate is a good candidate. And so it's incumbent upon all of us who are interested in the process to find people who have the qualities that will make them good legislators and make them good candidates. Because otherwise, we're going to cede the terrain to people who aren't such good legislators and aren't particularly good candidates. So you can help us.
In 2007, the last time I was in charge of a redistrict of candidate recruitment, we took the Senate. We had great candidates, and some of them made great senators. We didn't win all the races, but we had carried enough. This time, I'm pretty heavily involved in the process, and I'm confident that we'll have good people.
You had a slide on K through 12. Could you speak for a second about higher education, the university system, how that is doing financially, and do you hear any voices that seem to be appearing in other states where we hear some of the state universities are eliminating English, history, and other liberal arts kinds of offerings?
Well, you know, we have, one of the things that, I'm trying to remember the difference between the House and the Senate budget on higher education. I can't remember what's more robust.
The big difference, you know, that we talked about is between the House and the Senate budget, there's $621 million, over $400 million that was directly related to the Medicaid expansion. The rest of it, money that you could indirectly tie to Medicaid expansion. One of the things that the House Senate budget did is they took a lot of money from higher education in the Senate budget. The legislative push, primarily in the Senate at least, has been from Northern Virginia legislators. I can tell you, I've run for statewide office twice, and in Fairfax County, you hardly have a meeting with anybody from Fairfax County, and they're not mad because their kids didn't get into UVA or William & Mary or Virginia Tech. But if you go on the campus of any of those, or the grounds, if you go on any of those great universities, most of the people you'll talk to are from Northern Virginia, most of the students. But there are always people, and until every kid that whose parents feel they deserve to get into one of these great universities get in there, they're going to send legislators down to tie. They're going to try to limit the ability of these schools to raise tuition. They're going to try to do everything they can to foul things up for these universities. And the reality is tuition is too high. It is going up too fast. But in large part, it's because the General Assembly has always found a way to cut higher education, because we know that with higher education, there's somebody else to pick up the tab, and that's the person who pays tuition.
Yeah. You know, last year I had a budget amendment that I inserted in the budget. It was a language amendment, and I thought it was a pretty good idea, because the state has consistently taken the position that we're supposed to be funding 65% of the cost of higher education. Of course, we never do it. So I put in a budget amendment that required House Appropriations Committee to come up with a plan by which we'd get to 65% over 10 years. Oh man, you would have thought I had horns. I mean, really. And because we have been underfunding higher education for years in the Commonwealth, and it's not just universities. I mean, the community college system, you know, we have an unbelievably great community college here in our area. And if you talk to people, the cost of tuition has been rising pretty dramatically. And those are a lot of the people who go there. It's either their entryway to a job or their entryway to a four-year. And if we're going to increase the number of college graduates, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's good for a state, we're going to get those increases by finding people who have not really thought about going to college, getting them in through the community college system that'll either get them access to a trade that pays a really good salary or get some access to a four-year that when they come out will give them a really good salary. So we got to think about higher education more. We've got to advocate for it more and find better ways to get more people in.
Speaking of community colleges, I see Frank Friedman at the back of the room, the president of PVCC. Welcome, Frank.
Yes, sir.
Actually, I have two questions, and they're both related to guns. And I will let you know I'm a gun owner. I have been a gun owner ever since I was a kid. But years ago, we used to have in the state of Virginia a one gun a month law, which I thought was an excellent law all the way around. And I understand that was put in place because we were known as a source of shipping guns to the north for all kinds of criminal activity. So why can't we get something like that back again? And that's one of my questions. And the other is what I saw happening here on the mall with a bunch of yahoos walking around pretending they were some kind of security force carrying military rifles. Now, mind you, I own some military rifles, so I would never dream of walking around with one of them anywhere. They go out to the range and nowhere else and so forth to be shot. Why can we not get some of those kinds of things restricted and get that one gun a month limit back again?
The one gun a month was one handgun a month.
Yeah, well, might have been.
Yeah, one handgun a month.
That's two.
It was kind of arbitrary, but it was the law for 20-some years, and it was taken off the books in, I guess, 2010 or 2011, and every year or so somebody introduces a bill to bring it back. The reality, it had been winnowed down so that it applied to so few people. People that had concealed carry permits, it didn't apply to them. It didn't apply to but very few people. And so we can have an argument about how effective the law was. But there are efforts to bring it back every so often. You know, David and I both had bills this session to basically give Charlottesville and Albemarle County the right to restrict carrying of weapons in public demonstrations. They didn't pass. I had bills because in the Hafey report, there was testimony from police officers that said they couldn't even figure out who was who on the mall, whether they were National Guardsmen or police officers or demonstrators. You know, and so I had a bill. I phrased it two different ways to basically give authority to localities to pass ordinances to prevent wearing garb in such a way as it imitates or imitates active duty military person, and that didn't pass either. You know, with the gun legislation, that there's not enough mature thought about public safety. There's too much people gather in their tribes, and they will not cross the Rubicon, so to speak, to really talk to the other people. The one bill that I had passed, 669, the TDO bill, I went to the chairman of the committee and I said, "Mark, you know, because I've known him for a long time and we're friends." And I said, "Please look at this bill differently than the other gun bills, because you know what's going to happen with the gun bills. They're going to be massacred." I said, "Look at this bill differently because here's what it does." And try to reason with him about individual legislation. The other bills, you know, we've just decided to divide up in tribes on it, and I think it's going to take an election before we can hopefully we can get to a place where we can talk. But honestly, it's been that way for most of the time I've been involved in this process.
You know, we on guns, we often don't make decisions based on the empirical data that's before us or the studies which show what works and what doesn't work, and we sort of react in terms of our emotions. There's a bill. We had a rule. Love this. We had proposed a rule change in the House, similar to what you have in the Senate, that would not allow people to carry weapons into the House gallery. Well, why would you need a weapon in the House gallery? You know, the argument was, and there was some logic to the argument. The argument was that if somebody came to visit the people's house and they couldn't carry their weapon into the House gallery, they would have to leave their weapon in their car. So you were disarming them between the point they left their car and the time they got to the gallery. I mean, logically that made sense. I mean, logically, but it was absurd. And see, that's... Now, does it make much of a difference if we prohibit that guns from coming in the gallery? I don't know. I mean, we had an incident a couple years ago in the House when I first got there where a member took out his firearm in his office and fired it. And it just happened to hit a Kevlar vest, which stopped the bullet. I happened to be in the next floor up. Thank God. And he said it was an accident. Now, that's kind of weird that it just happened to hit a Kevlar vest, but he said he discharged it an accident. The Rand Corporation just did a study of studies, and they found a couple of things, which I thought were kind of interesting. I don't think youngsters under the age of 21 ought to be able to buy assault weapons, but their study showed that it didn't have any effect. They did say that one thing does have an effect, universal background checks, that really does work to make sure that people who shouldn't have a weapon don't get it. Yeah. So at least let's use the evidence that we have.
The thing is, we have consensus that people who are felons and people who have been determined by some independent authority to be mentally ill should not have firearms. We know that. So why can't we just make sure they don't get them by having a universal background check? I think you can support the Second Amendment, which I do, and also believe in universal background checks and believe that there ought to be some limitation on the possession of a assault-style weapon, a military, like the AK-47. Since the 30s, we've banned possession of machine guns, automatic weapons, without a permit. So why shouldn't we have the same ban in place for weapons that are similar to that? And something else I think we ought to be able to develop consensus about: bullets that will pierce police armor. Why in the world should those be on the street? Why in the world should people be able to go into Walmart and buy them?
Other questions? Clarabelle?
Thank you. And I'd like to start off by thanking Senator Creede for being on the House, for being on the Senate Privileges and Elections Committee. I see you often. Good questions, et cetera. I have three bills specifically, all of which either failed, went to summer subcommittee, or were vetoed by the governor, or y'all voted against. I think we all are interested in voter integrity. We certainly, as you have commented, elections have consequences. We all want one vote, one person. There was a bill that was sponsored by Senator Obenchain that was sponsored last year, passed, was vetoed, sponsored this year, passed, and was vetoed. I believe both of you voted against it. That would require that for any locality that has more than 100% of its age-eligible population registered to vote, that the general registrars and electoral boards would have to investigate how that happened. There are many ways that it could happen, and all the bill required was that the registrars and electoral board would investigate their own locality. Mm-hmm. Could you please explain why you don't think that's a legitimate request?
I didn't think it was legitimate because Mark was basing his statistics on things that came, I think, out of the Weldon Cooper Center and not on the census. And I didn't think that, did he said there were five localities in Virginia?
Ten.
Well, I was not convinced that there was a case. There may be anomalies, but I was not convinced that it rose to the level that would require us to invest in investigations. And I voted against it last year, and I voted against it this year, and I'll vote against it again next year.
I don't doubt.
Unless I'm convinced that there is a case. Now, I can be convinced. I always reserve the right to be smarter tomorrow than I am today. So I can change my mind, but I'll have to be. It'll have to be proven to me that there's a problem.
The bill did not require any specific Weldon Cooper data or census data or any other data. So it would be the general registrars having their census data, the Weldon Cooper data, and it, as you pointed out, it could be a flaw in the number of people who are reported as living in a district. Absolutely. It could be that people who no longer live in that district are still registered, or they're dead, or they've registered twice.
Or they've moved somewhere. The kids have gone to college.
Exactly.
They've registered in the college town. And
they're still registered at home. If they're in Virginia, that should not happen in Varus. However, it does happen. So if the bill just said that if the number is greater than 100%, the general registrar must investigate. Doesn't say remove names, doesn't say accept, it just says look at the data and investigate. That's what the bill said, and I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. And I believe you vetoed it all. I voted against it also when it crossed over.
In a lot of this, sometimes I vote against these bills because I think they put too much of a burden on the local registrars. I don't know, frankly, what it means to, quote, investigate. I mean, if you're really going to go after stuff, you should go after fraud. And fraud showing up at the voting booth with a false ID or some trying to impersonate somebody, that's what you should be going after. Otherwise, you run the risk that you'd start taking people off the rolls who shouldn't be taken off the rolls. Then they show up to vote. They can vote legitimately because they've registered, but for some error, they've been taken off. What's their recourse? Provisional ballot. Maybe, or maybe they just walk away. I think a lot of these bills are trying to have the impact of discouraging people to vote when, in point of fact, I don't think you can really show much fraud. And the classic example of this is Trump's commission on fraud. They had to disband. They didn't have any basis upon which to do anything. Now, is there fraud? Yes, but it's infinitesimal. We have to figure out a way to allow more people to vote easier and not put up all these impediments, which I think a lot of these bills try to do.
I do. I take exception to that. It was the voter integrity, and
the other bill. I love when people brand these things voter integrity, as if everybody else has that corner on what integrity is, when in point of fact, it's an excuse to try to to prevent people from voting. And if you I know that lots of people talk about all this fraud out there, but I don't see it, and I don't think the National Commission saw it, and I don't think if you ask the registrars across this Commonwealth, they probably wouldn't tell you there's much going on. So let's make it easier. Let's not dress it up with this language that makes it appear something that it really isn't.
Then may I ask about one other bill that both of you voted against, and that would be Mark Peek's bill in the Senate that went to the House to request both the Department of Elections and the General Registrars to have access to the Social Security Administration to verify Social Security numbers. As you know, Virginia uses Social Security numbers for voter registration. And as you all know, in Harrisonburg, a student was prosecuted for making up Social Security numbers and registering successfully imaginary registrar's name, not mine, imaginary voters in Harrisonburg, only because a very astute registrar picked up on it and recognized the name as a dead judge. And this gentleman was prosecuted, not the judge.
Not a smart move on that guy's part.
Not very smart. If you're going to cheat, you ought to be a little more careful.
Yeah, true.
But the bill would require that we use the Social Security Administration to verify the Social Security numbers, because the Social Security number is how you register to vote in Virginia. And if you've made up a Social Security number or made up a name, then that imaginary person can vote.
I voted against it, and I think I was right, because we had a problem in one locality. We had a registrar catch the problem. I think that our focus should be on hiring good people to be our registrars, and not on requiring them to do something else that a lot of people are sensitive about their Social Security numbers, and it doesn't seem to me that it seems more of an intrusion on people, and I voted against the bill.
Mike Clarabell.
Social Security numbers are on your voter registration application. They are in the Virginia Electronic Registration Information System, and only a limited number of people have access. I'm proposing that we do background checks, and I hope that the two of you will support this, for people who have access to that list. If you are in the registrar's office, you should have to have a background check in order to be able to access over 5 million Social Security numbers. So, the only reason the man in Harrisonburg was prosecuted was because the registrar recognized the name as being a deceased judge. I can assure you that Cameron Sassnett in Fairfax is not going to recognize every name that comes across his desk.
Other questions?
You have one?
I have a client at 3, so I just really have a job.
a quick question. Is there any way that we can increase the number of insurance companies that participate in the insurance pool by expanding outside of the state of Virginia? We only have like one or two that are approved, and it doesn't make any sense to me that there should be a limit to the number of insurance companies that can participate.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me that it should be. There's not a limit to the number who participate. There's a limit to self-imposed limit, and they're making judgments based on the marketplace. And maybe if somebody, you know, we each had bills in the last session that tried to increase competition, and also tried to make available to people the ability to get on an insurance policy of say a local nonprofit or the Chamber of Commerce, and those bills went nowhere either. But some of this has to do with federal law and prohibitions against going over state lines.
The only insurance-related bill I had that passed says that if you're a sole proprietor, you can treat yourself as a small business under the Affordable Care Act and apply for a group policy that way, even if you're just one person and one person in your group. I don't think that'll affect a lot of people or benefit a lot of people, but we both of us did have legislation debate. I think yours did the same thing mine did, to basically say if you're doing business in Virginia, you have to be able to offer a policy everywhere, because we were concerned there was only one insurer in this region, and that drove up the prices. But the reason why the bills didn't pass, frankly, is because some of the managed care companies that now do Medicaid said, we're going to have to get out of the program. We're going to have to get out of Virginia if we're required to provide insurance everywhere. And so the solution is going to have to be federal. It's not state, because we're just not big enough to figure it out, Yeah, across state lines, it's going to have to be federal.
Yeah, we can maybe figure it out, but we don't have the money to do it. we're smart guys, right?
Now, please join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you.